Spiritual Companions. This is Joyce, your Radio Reading Service volunteer broadcaster, welcoming you to this edition of Animal Companions, where we read about the animals in our lives and how they affect us. Today I'll be reading another chapter from The Case of the Careless Kitten by Earl Stanley Garner, and if we have some time, I'll be reading some articles and newsletters about the animals in our life. We're going to start today's readings with The Case of the Careless Kitten by Earl Stanley Garner. In the past reading, we learned that Perry and District Attorney Hamilton Berger had a very confrontational meeting about Mason's unorthodox ways. Berger threatened to file charges against Della Street and have Mason disbarred, and Perry Mason said, "Well, then I guess I'm going to see you in court." And we start with Chapter 21. Judge Lankershim came to the bench amidst a swish of whispers from the crowded courtroom, which subsided as the bailiff pounded a gavel. "The people of the state of California versus Della Street," Judge Lankershim called. Mason got to his feet. "The defendant is in court and on bail. Let the records show that she has surrendered for the purpose of trial." "The records will so show," Judge Lankershim said. "She will remain on the same bail during the trial. I understand this action has been brought on for immediate trial pursuant to the stipulation of counsel."
"That's right," Hamilton Berger said.
"I would like to hear from the prosecution as to the nature of the case." Berger said, "Your Honor, I will make a brief preliminary statement. It is the contention of the prosecution that while the police officers were investigating a felony, to wit, an assault with a deadly weapon with intent to commit murder, committed by persons unknown upon one Jerry Templar, the defendant in this case willfully spirited away a certain witness, one Franklin Shore, who had information which, if communicated to the police, would have materially aided the police in the solution of the crime. Specifically, it is charged that the defendant in this case, fully aware of the full significance of the facts which this witness knew, concealed him from the police and continues to conceal him." "And the defendant has pleaded not guilty?" Judge Lankershim asked. "The defendant has pleaded not guilty and asked for a trial by jury," Mason said. "And to prove our good faith in the matter, we will accept without examination the first 12 names which are called to the jury box as jurymen to try this cause." Judge Lankershim looked over his glasses at Perry Mason. "You are, however, insisting upon a trial by jury?"
"Exactly," Mason said. "The trial by jury is guaranteed by the Constitution to the citizens of the state. We have lost too many of our constitutional guarantees by not insisting upon them. Upon behalf of this defendant, I insist upon a jury trial more as a gesture than otherwise. I would be perfectly willing to submit the matter to your Honor's discretion otherwise."
"Do you wish to accept Mr. Wason's stipulation that the first 12 names called to the jury box may constitute a jury, Mr. District Attorney?" Hamilton Berger, who had personally embarked upon the trial of the case, relegating his assistants to subordinate positions at the far corners of the counsel table, got to his feet.
"No, Your Honor, we will examine the jurors in the regular way."
Mason settled back in his chair. "I have no questions to ask of any juror," he announced with a smile. "I waive my challenges for cause. I waive my peremptory challenges. I am satisfied that any 12 American citizens who file into the jury box will give the defendant the benefit of a square deal with the evidence is in, and that's all the defendant wants." "The court will observe," Berger said acidly, "that counsel is using the excuse of waiving his rights as a peg upon which to hang a dramatic statement intended to impress the jurors in advance with..." "The court understands the situation," Judge Lankershim interrupted promptly. "The jurors will pay no attention to the extraneous comments of either counsel. Let's get on with the case. Under the circumstances, Mr. Berger, it devolves upon you to examine the jurymen on their voir dire." And examine them Berger did, with the painstaking, mathematical, searching questions which a man might have expected a prosecutor to use in a murder case.
while Mason tilted back in his chair, an amused smile on his face, his bearing indicating that he was paying no attention either to the questions or the answers. And somehow, the more Berger examined the jurymen, the more he made it appear that he was suspicious of their probity, of their impartiality, an attitude which contrasted unfavorably with that of counsel for the defense. Twice, his associate tried to warn him of this. Berger paid no attention to their warnings. He went doggedly ahead with the questions. When he'd finished, Judge Lankersham said, "Under the law, the court is called upon to examine the jurors for prejudice. It has never been the policy of this court, however, to restrict the questions of counsel. Therefore, the court has always permitted counsel to interrogate the jurors in the usual manner. But under the circumstances of this case, the court feels that it is incumbent upon it to see that no member of the jury is prejudiced for or against either side." Whereupon the judge asked a few searching but impartial questions and said to Hamilton Berger, "The defendant has waived both challenges for cause and peremptory challenges. Do you have any challenges?" Berger shook his head. Mason turned to smile at the jury. Gradually, he dawned on the courtroom that the ultimate effect of the entire procedure had been to accomplish what Mason had proposed in the first instance, namely, that the first 12 persons called should sit as jurors. The jury smiled back at Mason. Hamilton Berger made a brief statement to the jury, outlining simply what he expected to prove, followed by that of saying, "I will call as my first witness Helen Kendall." Helen Kendall, obviously conscious of the eyes of the spectators in the crowd courtroom, came forward and was sworn. She gave her name and address to the clerk, looked at Hamilton Berger expectantly for questions. "You have on occasion to remember the 13th of this month?" "I do." "I will call your attention to the evening of that day and ask if anything unusual happened." "Yes, sir." "What?" "In the first place, my kitten was seized with spasms, and I rushed it to the veterinary hospital, who said it was..." Berger held up his hand. "Never mind what the veterinary hospital said. That's hearsay. Just state what you know of your own knowledge." "Yes, sir." "Now, at about the time the kitten became ill, did anything else unusual happen?" "Yes, sir. I received a telephone call from my uncle." "What?" "I received a telephone call." "From whom?" "From my uncle." "You have two uncles?" "Yes, sir." "This call came from Uncle Franklin." "And by the words Uncle Franklin, you refer to Franklin B. Shore?" "Yes, sir." "When had you last seen Franklin B. Shore?" "Some 10 years ago, shortly prior to his disappearance." "Your uncle, Franklin Shore, had disappeared mysteriously some 10 years earlier?" "Yes, sir." Hamilton Berger said to the court, "I am asking leading questions on some of these points which are not disputed, but which I want to get before the jury." "No objection," Mason said. "What did your uncle say to you over the telephone?" "Objected to," Mason said, "as hearsay, incompetent, irrelevant, and immaterial." "If the court please," Berger announced, "I'm not seeking to adduce any facts that will bind the defendant as to the conversation, but only to show the condition which existed that there night, and as that only to the extent that it will be considered a part of the res gestae, explaining the moves of the various parties on that night." "I will overrule the objection," Judge Lancashire said, "but will later limit the purpose for which the answer may be considered by the jury." "What did your uncle say?" "He asked me if I knew who was speaking. I told him that I didn't. He then told me his name and went on to prove his identity." "That's a conclusion," Berger said hastily. "That may go out. What did he say?" "Well, he called my attention to certain things that only my uncle would have known about." "What I am after particularly," Berger said, "is what he told you to do." "He told me to go to Perry Mason, the attorney, and then to go to the Castlegate Hotel and ask for Mr. Harry Leach, who, he said, would take us to him. He told me that I wasn't to take anyone else into my confidence, that particularly I wasn't to let my Aunt Matilda know anything about it." "Your Aunt Matilda is the wife of Franklin Shore?"
"Yes."
"And later on that evening, in the company with Mr. Mason, did you make any effort to get in touch with Mr. Leach?"
"Yes."
"What did you do?"
"We went to the Castlegate Hotel. We were advised that Mr. Leach wasn't there. A note was delivered telling us where we could..."
"Just a moment,"
Hamilton Berger said. I'll produce that note and ask you if this is the note.
Yes, Berger said. I'll ask that it be received in evidence as People's Exhibit A. Then I'll read it to the jury.
The document was duly stamped, and Berger read it to the jury. Now, he asked Helen Kendall, what did you do with the reference to that? In other words, what was your next step after you received the document?
We went to the place mentioned.
There was a map with it?
Yes.
I will show you this map and ask if this is the one.
Yes, sir.
I ask that this be received in evidence as People's Exhibit B.
No objection, Mason said.
So ordered, Judge Lankersham announced.
And you went to the place indicated on the map? Berger asked the witness.
Yes.
What did you find there?
It was up in the hills back of Hollywood. There was a reservoir. A car was parked near the reservoir. A man was sitting in the car, sort of slumped over the wheel. He was dead. He had been killed.
That man was a stranger to you?
Yes.
Who was with you at the time?
My uncle, Gerald Shore, Mr. Perry Mason, and Miss Street.
Miss Street, you mean by Miss Della Street? The defendant is in this action?
Yes, sir.
And what happened next? What was done immediately after that?
We three remained near our car while Mr. Mason went to the telephone and called the police.
Then what happened?
The police came and asked, and then my Uncle Gerald drove us home.
And after that, we went to the hospital to call on Aunt Matilda, and then Uncle Gerald drove me home again.
By home, you mean to the Shore residence?
Yes, sir.
Then what happened?
They let me out at the residence. The others went to...
Never mind stating where they went, because you don't know, only what they told you.
But the others left, did they?
Yes.
Then what happened?
A friend came to call on me.
What was his name?
Jerry Templar.
He was a man with whom you had been quite friendly?
In a way, yes.
And who was in the house at the time?
Como, the servant, was sleeping in the basement.
Mrs. Parker, a cook and housekeeper, was in the room over the garage. Mr. Templar and myself were in the living room.
What happened?
We heard a peculiar sound coming from my Aunt Matilda's bedroom, a sound as though something had been tipped over. Then we heard the chatter of her caged lovebirds. Then, after a moment, we heard a peculiar noise which sounded like my aunt walking.
Is there anything peculiar about her walk?
Yes, sir. She drags her right foot when she walks and uses a cane. The thump of the cane and the peculiar dragging noise of the right foot are very distinctive.
And this walk sounded like your aunt's walk?
Yes, sir.
Then what happened?
I knew that my aunt wasn't in the house. I told that to Jerry.
He immediately walked down the corridor and opened the door of the bedroom.
Jerry had always been so big and strong that I guess I considered him invincible.
I never realized the danger in which I was placing him.
What happened? Berger asked.
Someone in the room shot twice. The first bullet just missed my head. The second one hit Jerry.
What did you do after that?
I don't know. I dragged Jerry away from the door, and then he recovered consciousness. He was unconscious for some little time. I don't know just how long. When he opened his eyes, I told him I must get an ambulance and a doctor. He said we could get a taxicab quicker, and I telephoned for a taxicab. We rushed him to the hospital, and an hour or two later, Dr. Everett Roslin operated on him.
You remained at the hospital?
Yes, sir.
Until after the operation and until after
I'd seen he was going to be all right.
Cross-examine?
Berger snapped.
Mason said, you don't know how long Jerry Templar was unconscious?
No.
It was all a nightmare to me.
You don't know how long it was after the shot was fired before you got to the hospital?
No, sir, I can't tell you the time.
And you don't know exactly how long it was after we left you at the house that last time before the shooting took place?
Well, it might have been
an hour. It might have been more than a half an hour. It was perhaps somewhere between a half an hour and an hour.
You can't fix it any closer than that?
No.
Were you about 14 years of age when your uncle disappeared?
Yes, sir.
Can you fix exactly the time when the kitten was first taken sick? That is, with reference to the time of that telephone conversation with your Uncle Franklin?
It was immediately after I hung up on the telephone that I noticed that the kitten was sick.
Did you notice that?
My attention was first called it by my aunt.
Your aunt, you mean Matilda Shore?
Yes, sir.
What did you do with the kitten?
I took it to the veterinary hospital. Berger said, "Just a moment, Your Honor. One important question I forgot to ask. I would like to interrupt to get it in the record." "No objection," Mason said affably. "After dinner that night, did you go back to see the veterinarian?" "Yes, sir." "And what was the condition of the kitten at that time?" "The kitten seemed to be well, but weak." "What did you do with him?" "I took him with me." "The veterinary suggested that." "Never mind what the veterinary suggested," Mason said affably. "Go ahead. Let her tell it." "I take it, Miss Kendall, the veterinarian suggested that if some person were trying to poison the kitten around the house, that it would be better to take it away from the house. And so you took it down and left it with Thomas Lunk, the gardener, did you not?" "Yes, sir," Mason said. "That's all." And Berger nodded. Hambleton Berger called Lieutenant Tragg to the stand. Tragg testified in the close-clipped, efficient manner of a police officer who'd been on the witness stand numerous times. He testified to receiving a telephone call, to going to the hills back of Hollywood, finding the body identified, the articles which were tied up in a handkerchief nearby the body, and testified as to the identity of the body. Tragg then stated positively that he had advised Mr. Mason that night, while the lawyer was at the Shore residence, that he desired the presence of Franklin B. Shore as a witness to appear before the grand jury, and that he stated to Mason the importance to the police of finding and examining Franklin Shore. Tragg then went to state his experience at the Shore home later on that night when he had been summoned to investigate the shooting of Jerry Templar. He testified what he had found, calling particular attention to the writing desk on which a lock had been forced open. He identified photographs showing the condition of the bedroom when he had arrived on the scene. Berger introduced those photographs in evidence. On cross-examination, Mason adopted a manner of good-natured affability. "Lieutenant, referring to this handkerchief, I call your attention to the laundry mark. Have you made any effort to trace that laundry mark?" "Well, yes." "And you found, did you not, that it was the mark given to Franklin Shore by a laundry in Miami, Florida, and that the laundry had been out of business for some 6 years?" "That's right." "You'll remember that when you first showed me the watch up in the hills back of Hollywood, I pointed out to you that, according to the indicator, the watch must have been wound at approximately 4:30 or 5 o'clock the day of the murder?" "Yes." "Now, have you examined the fountain pen?" "Yes." "And what was the condition of the fountain pen?" Tragg said, "It was dry." "According to your observations at the scene of the shooting of Jerry Templar, the assailant had entered through a ground floor window on the north side of the house. Is that right?"
"Yes."
"And in entering the room, had knocked over a nightstand or tabouret, which was the side of Mrs. Shore's bed?"
"Yes."
"Then you picked up a cane, which apparently was in the room, and had imitated the steps of Mrs. Shore?"
"I think that's a fair deduction from the evidence. Of course, I don't know that of my own knowledge.
But you did find a cane which was lying on the floor near the corner from which the shots had been fired?"
"Yes."
"By the way, Lieutenant, you stated, I believe, that you took Thomas Lunk into custody at a downtown hotel where he was registered under the name of Thomas Trimmer?"
"Yes."
"How did you happen to go to the hotel to make the arrest?" Tragg smiled. "I'm not going to divulge that." "It's not proper cross-examination," Hambleton Berger objected. "The witness certainly is entitled to protect the source of his information." Mason said, "I will withdraw the question and ask this in its place. Isn't it a fact, Lieutenant, that you went to the hotel because you received an anonymous telephone tip from some person who told you where Lunk was, the name under which he was registered, and the number of his room?"
"Same objection," Berger said.
Judge Lancashire deliberated the matters thoughtfully, then asked Mason, "What is the reason for asking this question, Mr. Mason?" "It simply goes to show the entire res gestae," he said. "As a matter of fact, Your Honor, it may be quite material. Suppose, for instance, that I had done or been the one who had given Lieutenant Tragg the telephone tip."
"You don't claim that you were?" Judge Lancashire asked.
"Not at present, Your Honor. But I think it's only fair to the defendant that the witness should answer that one question." "I'll overrule the objection," Judge Lancashire said. "I doubt that it's entirely pertinent, but I am going to give the defense the benefit of the widest latitude in cross-examination.
The question doesn't call upon the lieutenant to divulge in any way the source of his information. Answer the question. Trag picked his words cautiously. I received an anonymous telephone communication giving me approximately that information, Mason smiled. That's all. I call Matilda Shore as my next witness, Berger said. Matilda Shore, who was sitting next to the aisle, raised herself from the seat by clinging to her cane with one hand, the back of the seat in front of her with the other, and walked to the witness chair where the clerk administered the oath. While she was walking, the juror, as well as the spectators, had the opportunity to listen to the peculiar, distinctive sound of her steps. When she had given her name and address, Berger lost no time in getting to the point. You are the wife of Franklin B. Shore?
I am.
And where is Mr. Shore now?
I don't know.
When did you see him last?
Approximately 10 years ago.
Can you give us the exact date?
January 23rd, 1932.
And what happened on that date?
He disappeared. Someone was talking with him in his study, someone who wanted money. The voices were raised for a while in angry altercation. Then they quieted down. I went to bed. I never saw my husband after that. He disappeared. I knew, however, that he wasn't dead. I knew that someday he would show up.
Never mind what you felt or surmised, Berger interrupted. I just want to establish certain things to prove a possible motivation for the entering of your house by a person who was interrupted before he could achieve the purpose for which he had come. For that purpose only, I'll ask you if there were some checks which were cashed just before and after your husband's disappearance.
Yes.
One of those checks was for $10,000?
Yes, sir.
To whom was it payable?
A man named Rodney French.
There were several other checks?
Yes, sir.
Now, where were those checks when you saw them last?
They were in my bedroom, in a pigeonhole, in a desk, which was pushed back against the wall.
That was a roll-up desk?
Yes, sir.
And an old one?
Yes, sir.
It had been my husband's study. It was his desk.
You mean he had used it continuously up to the time of his disappearance as his desk?
Yes, sir.
And you were using it on the 13th of this month?
That's right.
And these checks, which I've mentioned, were in there?
Yes, sir.
There were about a dozen of them in the envelope, checks which had been put through the account within the last few days prior to his disappearance, or checks which had been written immediately before his disappearance and were cashed afterwards. Why were those checks segregated in that manner?
Because I thought they might prove to be evidence. I put them in an envelope and kept them in his drawer.
When did you leave your house on the night of the 13th?
I don't know exactly what time it was. I was getting ready for bed. It was probably around 10 o'clock. I followed my usual custom of drinking a bottle of stout and shortly afterwards became violently ill. Remembering that the kitten had been poisoned, I took an emetic and went at once to the hospital.
Where were the checks when you went to the hospital?
In the pigeonhole, in the desk.
How do you know?
I'd been looking at them shortly before. I hadn't left the bedroom except to go to the icebox and get a bottle of stout and a glass.
When did you next enter your bedroom?
The next morning, about 9 o'clock, when I was discharged from the hospital.
Did anyone accompany you?
Yes.
Who?
Lieutenant Trag.
At his suggestion, did you search through your room to see if anything was missing?
Yes.
Did you find anything missing?
No.
Berger produced the watch and fountain pen, which had been identified as having been found near Leach's body. Mrs. Shore stated positively they were the property of her husband, that he had had both of these objects in his possession the night he had disappeared.
Cross-examined, Berger said.
You couldn't find that anything was missing from your room when you searched it after your return from the hospital?
No,
Mason said. That's all. Swiftly, Hamilton Berger laid the foundation for a complete case. He called the autopsy surgeon, called Dr. Roslin, identified the bullets which had been taken from the wound inflicted on Jerry Templar and from the body of Henry Leach. He then recalled Lieutenant Trag to get the bullet which had been embedded itself in the woodwork of the Shore home, following which he called the expert from the criminal laboratory, who introduced photographs showing the distinctive scratches made by the rifling and by the pits in the barrel of the gun, showing the bullets had been fired from the same gun. Judge Lankershim glanced at the clock. "You will understand," he said to Berger, "that we are not trying the murder case at this time.
Yes, Your Honor, but we are showing the circumstances which surrounded the commission of the alleged crime in this case. We are showing the significance of what happened and the importance of having the police unimpeded in their efforts to solve these crimes. Judge Langersham nodded, glanced curiously at Mason, who seemed to be taking very little interest in the entire procedure. I will now call Thomas Lunk, Hamilton Berger announced with something of a flourish. Lunk came shambling forward. He seemed reluctant to testify, and Berger had to draw his story from him a bit at a time, frequently using leading questions, occasionally cross-examining his own witness, a procedure which Judge Langersham allowed because of the apparent hostility of the witness. Pieced together, Lunk's story made a convincing and dramatic climax to the case of the district attorney and what he had been building up. He told of how he had gone from the work that night, of how Helen Kendall had brought the kitten to his house, where it was left for safekeeping. He told of how he had listened to the radio, read a magazine, and while he was in the midst of reading the magazine, he had heard steps on the porch, knocking at the door. He had opened the door and then drawn back in surprise as he recognized the features of his former employer. Well, next week we'll learn more about the case and how Hamilton Berger continues to try Lunk in the case of The Careless Kitten by Earl Stanley Gardner. Well, I hope you've enjoyed the reading today, and I invite you back again next time to hear more stories about the animals in our lives and how they affect us. This has been Joyce Vesper, your volunteer broadcaster for Sun Sounds of Arizona, a radio reading service. Stay healthy, everyone. Be well and be happy. Bye-bye.